what that means, and I'll try my best to do it for you. What's the whole Zuck thing? Z-U-C-C. I haven't seen this. Kenneth, Mark, give me the Zuck. You can follow up and tell me what that means, and I'll try my best to do it for you.
Hello, friends. It's your Chapo this week. It's me, Will Menaker. And joining me is Amber, Brendan, and Matt this week. But sitting in, we have Cleo Chang, who's here to talk about her piece in The New Republic titled What Mark Zuckerberg Gets Wrong About UBI. So we've got an interesting combination here of the, you know, tech mogul turned possible presidential candidate and the concept of universal basic income. So, Cleo, to kick things off, what brings Mark Zuckerberg in contact with an idea like universal basic income?
Well, you know, the post that he had this week talking about UBI, he just flew to Alaska and he was like, check it out. They have a permanent fund. I'm going to use this to talk about, you know, my love for UBI, but
I love anyone who flies to Alaska, looks around, and like, this is fucking great.
Well, what is that? Like, so he took a trip to Alaska, and you mentioned the permanent fund. For people who don't know, what is the Alaska Permanent Fund, and how is it like UBI or not like it?
Yeah, so the Alaska Permanent Fund was created, I think, in the 70s, and basically they took a bunch of oil money and then invested it, and then they get dividends out. So once a year, if you're an Alaska resident, you will get money from the state, which a lot of people see as, you know, one of the few sort of real, close to real life examples of a universal basic income.
The state will just give you oil money and beaver pelts and a bear skin for your cabin.
Yeah. And you live like a king in, you know, Wasilla.
You don't get murdered by I would say 2/3 population of the state that is just fleeing crimes in the lower 48.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you're, you know, indigenous, that rules to be Alaskan.
But Cleo, but like you mentioned that this is his trip to Alaska as part of his, as you describe it, I'm not running for president listening tour.
2020.
Like we've seen him, you know, photographed at diners, you know, smiling at good hearty Americans as they sip their coffee and
I love him trying to do the Biden thing.
He needs to start groping people in those diners if he's going to do the Biden thing. But what is universal basic income? How would it work? And what is like Zuckerberg's vision of it?
Right. So Alaska was not the first time he's mentioned it. He's mentioned it at like a Harvard commencement speech. I think it's just generally a really popular policy among people in Silicon Valley. And the general idea of a UBI is that, you know, everyone gets a monthly check from the government or, you know, monthly, yearly, weekly, whatever, however you set it up. And it just ensures that no one dips below a basic standard of living, right? So everyone has a base floor of this is how much they get. And it's seen as like a pretty on the left as a way to help eradicate poverty. And then in the more libertarian right view, they also love UBI often because it's they see it as replacing the welfare state. Right. So it's less bureaucratic. The government's not telling you what to do. And instead of giving people all these other things, like we'll just cut them a check. It'll be easy. And like you can get out of the way.
So like a left wing vision of a UBI would be, everyone gets a check to ensure like a certain basic level of income in addition to the welfare state that already exists in the form of things like Medicaid, Social
Right.
Security, like housing and education and things like that. The libertarian view would be that it would supplant entirely all of those things.
Yeah, on the most extreme level, right.
Yeah. Like you mentioned in the article, Charles Murray has been a proponent of this idea, like sort of because it's an attractive way to kind of wash your hands of most of the population of this country if you just sort of feel like, well, we gave them a check,
right.
So what more do you want?
Yeah.
But why specifically, you mentioned also in addition to Zuckerberg And, you know, he's doing this odd, like you said, not running for president thing. He has his eye on something, whether it's the presidency, or I think he wants to influence politics in this country in a much bigger way than he already does. But you also mentioned Elon Musk and this guy Sam Altman of Y Combinator, who have also spoken about UBIs and is, or Altman at least has funded a pilot program in Oakland based around it. Is this because Silicon Valley, like, is it because they're cognizant of like how much their obsession with technology and disruption is disrupting work and the labor market in the next 5 to 10 years? So they're seeing it as sort of like a must, that's like the necessary like outgrowth of automation and technology, basically putting people out of work.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You know, they see, and I don't know if this is, I don't think this is like proven, but they see the future as soon, you know, we'll be totally automated out of jobs, and we need to figure out a different way to give income to people. So it's kind of like this is the what their industry is causing, and then they're going to solve it through a basic income.
Well, and this is part of sort of a larger cultural kind of investment in efficient, austere living. I mean, these are the same people who are pushing for tiny homes and Soylent. It's like, what is the bare minimum that people will stay alive and not revolt and, you know, run into Silicon Valley with hay forks and torches? You know, how can we keep them alive and safe and functioning without actually giving them any power whatsoever over their lives?
Well, you mentioned in the article this guy Altman, and in it, it's this idea that, like, okay, so if you have a UBI, let's say it's instituted on a national level, and you create a floor, but he's very specific that he wants a floor but not a ceiling in it. So, like, he wants to make sure that, like, you know, people don't fall beneath like a certain baseline, which is okay. But on the other hand, he says, like, well, I'm going to be as rich as is possible. Right. He even quotes, as rich as they fucking want. And he says that we need to get used to the idea of a world with trillionaires in it. Not just tech billionaires, but trillionaires, where individuals become as wealthy as nation states, basically. He said, like, there's something, he says, quote, we need to be ready for a world with trillionaires in it, and that's always going to feel deeply unfair. It feels unfair to me, but to drive society forward, you've got to let that happen. So it's sort of like, it seems like you're creating a floor just so you can get rid of the ceiling, basically, and make it just drive even more this insane inequality.
Well, and one of the most obvious criticisms of UBI from the left even is, who decides what the floor is?
Right. Out of like, Cleo, like, out of like your research into UBI, like, practically though, what would be like a monthly income for UBI? Like, does it vary? Is like, what statistics have you seen quoted?
I mean, it's like, it just depends on how much you want to tax and like what you can do. Like, you can, it's hard. I mean, at what point is it like, are you free from work, right? If it's too low, you still have to get a job, and maybe jobs will pay less because there is a UBI. If it's too high, people are always like fear mongering that people will become lazy and terrible.
Well, like, and it takes the onus off of employers to provide a wage that is in any way livable.
But like, I was like, what does the Alaska Permanent Fund pay out? And what is
it? Not that much. It's like I'm not sure, but something like $1,000 a year. It's like very little. Yeah, it's not like a livable. It's not a living wage at all.
Yeah, but everybody gets a snow machine. That's part of it. Every year you get a new model snow machine.
Suburban Alaska, by the way, is like the most bleak setting I can possibly imagine. It's where did he go? Like, I want to know what picturesque town he went to. I mean, I'm sure he didn't go to some wildcat town and looked around at these immiserated.
I think the way he's even managing to do this this presidential like tour and mixing with the riffraff is that they have him wear like VR contacts, where he's going around and seeing a glorious, you know, sunny world with all these fellow entrepreneurs shaking his hand and what they're saying.
Send him to Wasilla. But send him to meth country.
He's not actually seeing the dirty.
I heard that he went to Barrow for the 30 days of night and drank everyone's blood. They made a movie about it. Seriously, when he sees these like regular Joes, when he goes to dinner with the Trump family in Ohio or hangs out with the maple syrup fuckers in Alaska, do none of them just like say, why do you have no facial features? Like, does no regular person ever just in an unguarded moment say, dude, what? Your face is just a smooth...
Why my man got a face like a lenticular...
There's nothing more unnerving than his blank, absolutely expressionless, unmoving, smooth, white, pale disc hovering in the air over his polo shirt and staring at you with those eyes.
His doppelganger is the drugged up Mr. Burns that everyone thinks is an alien, yeah, that I bring you love. Yeah. And equally, he also does not bring you love. He brings you fear.
I mean, back to the Alaska thing and the, like, Zuck's interest in it, I think it's very telling because you have this guy who's, you know, immensely wealthy and has set his eyes on something outside of just money, right? Because once you have a certain amount of money, it, like, doesn't really matter anymore. Like, it's just theoretical at one point. And I always think of the line that John Huston says to Jack Nicholson's character in Chinatown, where Nicholson says, you know,
how much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
And I think that's what Zuckerberg's interested in. And I think the way he talks about this, and you can tell that he's already kind of aping this, like, consensus politics style when he talks about something like the UBI, which I guess is mostly considered like a left-wing position. But it's interesting in the way he talks about it, because you can't talk about something that's like a social democratic universal program without couching it in the terms of, like, entrepreneurship.
Yeah. And he was like, you know, smaller government, bipartisanship, mm-hmm. You know, so, you're like, what?
Yeah, you quote him here talking about the Alaska Permanent Fund. He says, this is Zuckerberg now, he says, seeing how Alaska has put this dividend in place reminded me of a lesson I learned early at Facebook. Organizations think profoundly differently when they're profitable than when they're in debt. When you're losing money, your mentality is largely about survival. But when you're profitable, you're confident about your future and you look for opportunities to invest and grow further. Alaska's economy has historically created this winning mentality, which has led to this basic income. That may be a lesson for the rest of the country as well. So, yeah, the winning mentality of Alaska and its sort of, like, just oil wealth.
Alaska hasn't seen a lot of other states at the bank. It's got the it's got the winning mentality.
Yeah,
though.
He just wants to run the country like Facebook, which shouldn't terrify us
at
all.
That's a good idea.
Mm. What could go wrong?
I like your line in It Clear where you say, I'm paraphrasing, but what was the last time you remember someone saying they want to run America like a business?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, like, one of the big problems with Silicon Valley, right? They think everything they learn from their industry is applicable to solve the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
It just can't be true.
But they're all people who are, I mean, like, I think in their minds, genuinely, like, liberal, and they have, mm-hmm. like, you know, liberal values about society, but, like, they're not really interested in politics or history or human beings. Like, they have this idea that you can run the country like a startup.
What about the new WTF political group?
Oh, yeah. Win the Future. We just talked about that last week. And, they want to disrupt the Democratic Party with the former lead singer of Third Eye Blind.
Yeah.
As we mentioned.
I cannot wait.
Put the tweets on billboards.
You know what? All bets are off now. That could absolutely happen. I can't predict the future anymore.
No, but, like, these guys who want to run the government like the Valley, have any of them confronted the fact that Silicon Valley hasn't actually, like, created anything?
Well, it's great.
Like, most of those businesses are just cannibalizing shit and, like, just scooping up venture capital. And to the degree that they do make money, it's basically just by arbitraging regulations with other industries. They're not actually making anything.
Yeah. Well, they create wealth.
But, Cleo, at the end of your piece, you get to the sort of nub of the, I think, a kind of critique of UBI as a concept. And you write here, tech moguls may seem like tempting allies for UBI advocates, but their vision of an ideal social safety net does not look anything like the left's. If it did, they wouldn't be pushing just for a basic income, but for also for things like universal healthcare, free public education, not just for engineers, and strong labor unions. For Silicon Valley, UBI is a sleek technological means to a very different end. And I think, as we've kind of hinted at, that end is sort of ameliorating the effects of
joblessness, hopelessness, and vastly unequal income disparity between trillionaires and the rest of us. And instead of the end being a more equitable, more humane society where more people have more control over their day-to-day lives.
But why would they want that when they can be kept like gerbils in tiny homes with just like Soylent comes from a spout and, they get their stipend every day?
Like, Amber, we were talking about this like a little before, like UBI, like, you know, it's a seductive idea because, you know, who wouldn't want money for nothing, chicks for free?
Yeah.
But it does contain,
which is like, basically us.
Yeah, but it does contain a germ of a very dark idea, which is that let's say we do have a universal basic income program in this country, like other sort of welfare programs of the past. I think the lesson we've seen is how easy they are to defund and do away with, even if you get some sort of meager handout.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for cash handouts. Please give me some. But what we have seen historically with sort of cash welfare stuff is that the pool of people that are entitled to it, for lack of a better word, is always being sliced more thinly. Mm-hmm. And the benefits themselves are always being cut. And those things tend to work together. I mean, one of the most tempting things about the idea of universal basic income, I think, to a leftist is the word universal, because I think people tend to understand that, good welfare programs work for everyone and bad welfare programs just work for the poor. Because if something is good, middle class people want it, rich people want it. But the truth is that income isn't a universal concept. I mean, if you have cancer, your income is going to need to be higher to meet your needs. There's all kinds of factors that affect the necessity of your income. You can argue that there would be this complicated Vox wonkish set of standards and amendments, and like, you know, there would be lots of charts, and you could say, well, you know, has your cancer reached stage two or stage three? Well, then you're going to get an extra $200. Congratulations.
Right.
But that's horrible and unnavigable and impractical.
And like things like, I mean, I think if you did have some sort of universal basic income, I don't think there's any way that rent seekers in the economy in general
wouldn't immediately adjust to it.
I mean,
absolutely.
I guarantee you, we already, in a situation with flat and declining wages, are seeing just this insanely unsustainable rise in rents. Those are
absolutely
only going to go up in a situation where people are getting money from the government. Yeah, that's why I like the idea of like of decommodifying essential shit, like healthcare,
right,
and housing and things like that. Like taking them out of the cash nexus entirely.
I completely agree. I think UBI is really popular in the media class because so many of us are freelancers, and to us we just think, well, if I just had an extra $15,000 a year, then I would be okay. But that's not most people's lives. The other thing is that it costs more to be poor. I mean, the example that's easiest to point out is grocery stores. I mean, if you're not near a grocery store, like a good grocery store, you require more time to get to a good one, or you spend more at a bodega, which is what a lot of people have to do.
Or you buy like a single roll of toilet paper instead of a 24-pack.
Exactly. It just costs more to be poor. So the idea that income could ever be, a consistent thing across the board is, you know, completely ridiculous. And the final thing that I would point out is that it makes sense in some ways to think of poverty as sort of a location. And if you were to, say, give all of the people of Flint cash payouts, what the fuck are they going to do? Buy more bottled water? I mean, to correct a problem like that, something like environmental racism, although it's not just racism, there's tons of white towns in Pennsylvania with shitty, undrinkable water, too.
We talked to Jacob about that when we were in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I mean,
Pittsburgh had the same problem with their municipal water supply.
Yeah, it happens. It happens in rural places. It happens in urban places. You can't correct that with cash payouts, which is why socialism needs to be a political problem and not a single, you know, welfare policy, which will always be vulnerable, which will always be exploited by the capitalists, and which does nothing to actually empower working class people.
Let me ask Cleo, like, let's say, you know, UBI is an idea that's in vogue among these incredibly wealthy and powerful people. Do you think that there's any benefit in collaborating or I don't know, or in pushing this idea, as long as it's how far it can go, like in the mainstream?
I mean, I think so. I think, like, to be fair, you know, both Zuckerberg and Allman have mentioned taxing wealthy people before to pay for this. It's not like they don't have this idea, but to me, it's really what's scary to me is that they love UBI, but they're not like out there defending healthcare, like, you know, like things that are really real and under attack right now.
Things that should actually be universal.
Yeah. And like another big example is that I think UBI is really flashy, and it's good that they're getting it's getting attention and stuff like that. And I think that's a like bonus. You know, right now most countries have something that's called like a child allowance, which is that you give money to every child. Countries in Europe, countries in Asia, like everywhere, there's a national policy of, it's like basically universal basic income for kids, because kids are usually poorer than adults.
Well, because they're stupid and they don't know anything.
Because they don't work.
Yeah. Stupid children need the most attention.
They're lazy. They have not built their skill set.
But like, yeah, why aren't they pushing that? You know,
kids,
like,
they have no skills at all.
Why would you reward
skilled.
That?
Yeah.
But like, I haven't heard any of like, any push for a child allowance from these guys, and my idea is like, it's just less flashy, right? It's not as interesting.
Well, it's
them.
A feminist policy, essentially. So why would you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Silicon Valley. Yeah. Well, Silicon Valley, you know, next week's New York Times headline will be, we've got a lot of learning to do. But okay. So like, let's say, I mean, it seems like pretty much politically impossible now, but you know, who knows what things will be like in 5-10 years. Let's say you know, we could finance every single American gets, I don't know, $15,000 a year from the government, and it's paid for by raising taxes on the wealthy. Would any of us, I mean, would you turn that down now? Or just,
you do the UCB response, which is yes and.
Okay.
Yeah. That's fine.
Just good. Just do.
But that's not enough. You don't stop there. Because right. Amber and I were talking
They about, never stop. That's yeah. why right. they have so many rape scandals.
Right. Okay. We were talking before that, you know, that inherently, however much UBI could be used to benefit the marginalized, the vulnerable, and the poor, inherently, it is not antagonistic to capitalism itself. It is, as Cleo wrote in her article, a mediation, you know, between the awful effects and the guys at the top, who in the very article say that they can still get as rich as they want, even if there's taxes on them and stuff like that. But there's
if you have $1 trillion, yeah. What the fuck is like taxes?
And it doesn't
do?
Challenge that, because it's not really a showdown between class interests, between everybody and the super rich. It's just a benign and possibly inoffensive new welfare mechanism that perpetuates the system and actually probably makes it run smoother. Because as we know, lots of, you know, liberal additions and expansion packs to capitalism, even though sometimes the upper class fights it, they actually do stabilize the system rather than truly attack it.
In terms of that, I want to get back to what Matt and Amber mentioned a little earlier, this idea of decommodification being like a more promising horizon for a like socialist or leftist vision of a better society. And when you say decommodification of necessary goods, we're talking about housing, education, healthcare, anything other than that?
Elder care, child care, food. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can institute these things. I think there's arguments to be made for different programs. One of the actual like universal payouts I think could be a really good idea would just be food stamps for everyone, because the idea that you know, agriculture. They wouldn't be able to immediately jack up their prices to take advantage of that because their agricultural price controls and their food price controls. Or, you know, hey, I love the Soviet model. Let's just all seize the Whole Foods hot bar, and that's for everyone now. And everyone stops by, and you pick up your family's meal, and we just need to – I mean, the truth is that we require so much more infrastructure, too. I mean, there aren't enough hospitals. The MTA in this city is insane. It's literally in a state of emergency. There should be so many jobs for people building new things right now.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, and in terms of like infrastructure, I think one of the you know amazing and handy things about you know capitalism and a corporation like Amazon, for instance, which is basically, I think, within the next 5-10 years is going to basically be in charge of like all American consumption. Like they're going to be in charge of like basically everything you buy and get. Amazon is in
you know,
some
in
way,
some ways, they're doing the work for us. They're consolidating, yeah. And now yeah. We just need to take it.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like a company like Amazon or Walmart, for instance, has these like quite efficient. I mean, like it really works. Like the distribution chain. I mean, like the supply chain that allows all this to happen is deeply monstrous and should be dismantled. Yeah. But like,
right, but in some ways, it's Bolshevik capitalism. I mean, Bolshoi means big.
So like, we're talking.
You need these large programs.
So like, we're talking about trillionaires, and like someone like Jeff Bezos or Amazon eventually already is basically like its own nation state, and a possible role for like a left-wing or socialist government in the future would just be to nationalize Amazon and take over its distribution networks and just get people the things that they want, but at a kind in a decommodified way as a kind of like.
I mean, there's still so much work to be done just because, again, the geography of poverty. I mean, we need that's another one, of course, obviously, is transportation needs to be decommodified.
But just to be sure, we're real clear here. When we say decommodified, what's another way of saying free is another way of
saying
that.
Made free.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's just no reason why we didn't do that. But we need to build so many more hospitals and schools, and we need to replace our subway system with something that doesn't catch fire all the time. That's just me.
Another critique of UBI comes from people who, for the reasons that we've outlined here, would prefer a jobs guarantee over a UBI, or just like
that's generally the dichotomy that's presented. I'm with Matt. I'm very third way on this. I'm like hardcore. I mean, just start working on necessary services. Start looking at what are the things that everyone needs. Everyone needs a clean environment. Everyone needs housing. Everyone needs food. Everyone needs health care. The young need to be cared for. The old need to be cared for. You know, it's matriarchal communism. There's a really excellent documentary, I think, called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth. And I think it's on YouTube. And it's about a really beautiful, ambitious public housing project that when people moved in to, they were incredibly excited about.
This is in St. Louis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Brown v. Board of Education happened, which, you know, it's the major legal precedent for desegregation, but it shows that this kind of negative liberty is not the way to do desegregative policies, because what immediately happened is they had to desegregate housing projects, and people reacted to that with hostility, obviously because of racism. So to sort of deal with that backlash, they had like a home loans program so that, you know, white flight could happen. And theoretically, of course, black people would be able to take advantage of these things too. But of course not. You know, people immediately formed, you know, racist housing organizations. You know, they immediately formed these, you know, quote unquote communities of people that wanted to live around each other. And thus, you know, the Pruitt-Igoe projects just descended into shit. And when I talk about like the geography of poverty, you have to sort of forcibly not just you know, see to poor neighborhoods, but to destroy the very idea of a poor neighborhood. We have to actually have forced integration, not just racially, but like economic integration if you know, people's environments and lives and self-determination is ever actually going to be met.
I have one last question for Cleo, and I'm going to also open it up to anyone else who wants to answer this. What would we talked about nationalizing Amazon or Walmart and their massive distribution chains that do get people the stuff that they want and need. What would a nationalized Facebook or Silicon Valley look like, and what use could it be put? In you know, the Chapo year zero new American government.
Man, I think I have a lot of more friends on Facebook, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. What would that even look like?
I mean, it's exciting to think about. Because that is the thing about all this tech shit. It's like, it theoretically is exciting. I mean, I'm not a Luddite.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cool if Facebook weren't evil. Like, what if Facebook... but not evil. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah. And, you know, like, you know, Zuckerberg would still be rich, but he wouldn't be in charge of Facebook anymore.
He'd be a brain in a jar.
He'd be floating in the rectangle that they shoot the Superman 2 villains. They would just shoot him in there.
Yeah, no. He has to be banished to a cosmic prison.
Yeah.
No, but I mean,
rich. Like, he's rich inside of that rectangle.
But the idea that, like, you know, the internet, and we've talked about when we had Adam Curtis on, like in Hypernormalization, contains this utopian idea of this kind of network of people that you can communicate and have access to information that's, like, you know, not mediated by governments or like the man or anything. And of course it always is, but like, I think it would just be Facebook where you could talk to your relatives, but like, there wouldn't be any fucking ads. You wouldn't be selling yourself constantly to the gaping maw.
Your data would,
like,
not be collected for the purposes of selling you more shit and directing you toward, you know, all of the horrible.
It would just exist as
no one would be watching you looking at the weirdest porn that you look at.
I hope someone in the NSA does have to do that, though, because
oh, they do.
To me, yeah,
there's so many of them.
I think that's a good revenge against the surveillance state, to be honest.
Yeah, they'll quit and just have like PTSD. Like, seeing so many, like, grim-faced virgins.
Yeah,
just staring at Bang Bus for the third hour in a row.
Or just depression, you know. He's masturbating again. Anyway, well, that's a good place to leave it. Cleo, you want to stick around? We're going to do Amber advice column, where sure. I'm going to ask Amber and everyone else real Dear Prudy questions.
I cannot wait.
We're gonna maybe have Amber's gonna, you know, have another drink.
I'm gonna
first.
Have another drink. Yeah. Give drunk advice. I give advice best when drunk, because I'm much less inhibited and far more bossy and judgmental.
Okay, all right. Let's take like a 5 minute break,
sure,
and we'll okay.
I never log in, so I don't know my own email.
We should use the show to plug more of our own personal projects.
Yeah.
Amber's column, my...
your music,
my
career.
Music, your...
my Instagram.
Whatever the fuck you do.
Photos of stray cats.
Yes.
Follow CodyDad420 on the gram. See all of the stray cats of Bed-Stuy that I come across. That's my current project. All right. We are back. And now... for the second half of the show, I want to do something now that is going to take advantage of the talents and other occupation of one of our co-hosts. I'm speaking, of course, about Amber, who is a certified advice columnist. If you didn't know that already, frankly, I don't know why you're listening to this show. But for those of you not in the know, Amber, you write the advice column for The Baffler.
I do.
You're Sorry Ass.
Yes, it's called You're Sorry Ass, and the tagline is bossy, judgmental advice on how to live your life fairly, kindly, and with good humor.
Now, true Will Menaker heads will know that, you know... real motherfucking Will Menaker hours here for longtime fans of the WM will know that I'm a big fan of advice columns. I don't give advice myself, but I'm a big fan of the questions that are asked in advice columns. And my favorite advice column, outside Amber's, of course, is Dear Prudy. Dear Prudy, that's my special little treat whenever I go to slate.com.
Oh, it's great.
I need to see that.
I envy the Dear Prudy questions, because I mostly get reasonable people.
By the way, well, to our listeners who are surely, you know, imbalanced loners, alcoholics, the unemployable. If you've got problems in your life,
send me your
sound off in the comments. Your sorry ass at baffler.com.
Yeah, your sorry ass at thebaffler.com.
Thebaffler.com, excuse me. But yeah, Amber will sort your shit out.
Mm-hmm.
But however, Dear Prudy, that's my shit. And we did a segment similar to this with Liza Featherstone a while back, who's also an advice columnist, where I asked her other advice columns questions. So I'm now going to, for my own personally curated stash of Dear Prudy questions, I'm going back into the archives and I'm going to try out a few on Amber and
I'm
Brendan
ready.
And Cleo and Matt and you, the listener.
The
we're all
dank gonna... Prudy stash.
So... let's just dive in and hopefully help these people out with their problems. Everyone who wrote into these Dear Prudy, they are surely dead by now.
Yeah,
it's like,
good.
You know, so, but they can't be helped anymore.
Or they're not real. I will say, yeah. My column, I do not invent the questions.
Ooh, okay. So that's a gauntlet thrown to other
I'm just saying, advice some columns. Some of these things you read them and you're like, oh, come on.
But... who knows? Maybe you, the listener, have a similar problem with a loved one, relative, spouse. Invariably, these are always the source of problems in our life. Fake friends and fake relatives. Okay, first question to Amber. You'll get first crack at it, but if anyone else has any other possible solutions, feel free to chime in. First question. My husband forces me to give him hugs. I know this sounds like a really stupid problem to have. He has created a hug toll and won't let me leave the room until I give him a hug. Here are some examples. I am running late for work and need to rush out the door. He will physically block my exit until I give him a hug. He doesn't do this in the way that will hurt me. He'll just pick me up until I give him his hug, then he'll let me go. Another scenario is, if we are downstairs and I have to use the bathroom, he will block the stairs until I hug
Good
him.
God.
It's really annoying. Sometimes I just don't feel like giving hugs. I have told him this, but he just laughed at me. The hug tax is really obnoxious. How do I make it stop? He is 100 pounds heavier than me and a foot taller, so I can't push my way out. How can I make it stop?
Oh my God.
Prudence, I love hugging him, just not on command. He's a hug bully.
Sign Jody Arenas.
Amber, help the sister out.
Oh, get a divorce. Just immediately. You know what? Don't even get a divorce. Just pack your shit, run, get an annulment. I'm sorry. Will knows this about me because I am the first person of any friend group to tell you to quit your job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also the first person to tell you to end your relationship. Just quit life. Skip town. Change your name. Dye your hair red. Maybe look good as a redhead. That's my advice for everything. But yeah, I mean, like, the fact that at the end, she's like, he's bigger and stronger than me. I can't fight him. It's like, this person is a... like, this is a very soft assault. that's very... that's very not okay. I would, I guess. I mean, I know this person is long dead, or never existed.
They've
at
been
all.
Hugged to death.
Yeah, yeah. They literally had a constriction related injury that killed them after 3 days when an embolism popped in their brain. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. No one's allowed to demand affection of you when you don't want it.
That's a good rule of thumb, I think, in relationships.
Yeah.
But, like, I just love the idea of, like, stopping you from going to the bathroom until you give a...
Also,
give
don't a hug someone when they have to pee. That can...
Just pee on him. Just pee on him, you know? Like, if he's stopping
they're
you.
In the animal kingdom, that's how a lot of animals escape.
But, like, you know, granted, when I read these Dear Prudy questions, of course, my answer in my head is always... get out of this relationship.
Yeah, I mean, that's the answer to like all of the questions.
But like, let's say you didn't have, you don't have that cheat code of divorce. Like, what would you tell this lady? How would you talk to her hug bully husband?
Yeah, I think I would say, look, you are not allowed to demand any kind of physical affection of me. These things have to be mutual. Otherwise, obviously, I'm going to start resenting you, and I'm not going to want to give you any affection at all. You know, Therapy is underrated. Now, but
a Dennis Prager two-parter column saying what you do when your wife won't let you hug her. That was one of the most depraved things we've ever read.
That's still the most awful thing.
And it's tangentially related to this. Go back and listen. I think it's episode 16 or 14.
It's early.
Go back to SoundCloud. Dennis Prager's face is on it. He's playing an accordion. And listen to it because we read his truly repulsive, disgusting column about basically how you should be able to command your wife to have sex with you at any given moment.
And also, he makes clear in that column, it doesn't really matter if she's into it or not.
It's
explicit.
It's like, very dark. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I mean,
to this interview or listening to this question, it's like, man, it's so easy to be an advice columnist. One word, taser.
Okay.
Do it once. You'll never have to do it again.
Okay, let's move on to another marriage. Let's just take a peek through this keyhole. Here we go. My husband and I have been married just over a year. He is a hard worker and keeps busy doing little chores all the time. We've been running into a frequent problem lately, and it happened again this weekend. We were at a family vacation house, and the lawn needed to be mowed. It is a normal-sized yard, kind of big, but not a field or anything. It took him 5 hours to mow. 5 hours. He was riding a lawnmower and went over it a zillion times. I weeded the flower beds, but around hour three, I started losing my patience. We were on vacation. I thought that mowing wouldn't take all morning and some of the afternoon.
Bitch, you suck at vacations.
He didn't care if it did. He thinks I'm a jerk for complaining about him helping. I think he's a jerk for unilaterally deciding to use up 5 hours of our weekend without talking to me about it. So where do we go from here? We're still frustrated with how it went down.
What is this? How do I answer this? You're both insane people. Okay.
I just like the idea of this is why I love advice columns.
Why was she fucking weeding the flower bed on vacation?
She could, read a book or whatever. But like what I like about these advice columns is that they give you these kind of like this keyhole view into just the desperate misery of other people's relationships.
many unanswered questions, It's like, maybe he has obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
Maybe he just wants to get the fuck away from her.
Yeah.
So he's just going on a little joyride on the riding mower. That's just such a weird... I'm sorry. I'm stuck on I spent 3 hours weeding the flower bed on my vacation. Like, it sounds like you're both Amish or something.
It sounds like they're
what is this Protestant vacation you're taking? It sounds terrible.
It sounds like they're both just desperately avoiding talking to each other or doing anything together.
And it sounds like you don't like each other.
I just love the image.
Which is a larger problem.
I just love the image of this guy robotically circling this lawn on a riding mower for 5 hours.
What if he's like replaying all the horrible scenes in his head from Iraq?
You have to sort of take it, you know, the word of the person writing into you.
Yeah.
But most of the time, you're really just like walking in on an Edward Albee play.
Oh, God. Yeah.
With these like just people who hate each other. And it's like, oh, you're just trying to drag me into your hell. Oh, shit.
Yeah. And I mean, people don't usually actually write for advice because they want advice. It's because they want someone to give them permission to do what they want to do. But this person is genuinely confused.
This person doesn't know what they want.
Yeah.
Well, the husband is either, as you say, trying to just, you know, spend time away from the wife, but it's going, this time it's just for me. And then or he's the guy from A Serious Man who keeps judiciously clipping
the
into
property
the
lines,
other.
The poplar.
Yeah.
Here's the next one. This is a good one. And for this one, I'm actually going to read the headline of the question. This is the spoiler. The headline here is question. Mother-in-law brings moldy food when visiting.
There you have it.
My parents-in-law live 11 hours away and come to visit my husband, myself, and our three young children about 6 times a year. That's already too many times. Already way too much for an 11-hour trip. Okay.
We've already got the problem already established.
So many of these people like bury the lead.
Okay.
They could bring an armful of piping hot baguettes.
That's too often. That's too too often.
Says, on each visit, they usually stay for 3 or 4 days.
No!
Ooh.
And they stay with you.
Yeah, not in a hotel. Ooh, yeah. Every time they come, my mother-in-law packs a cooler with leftovers from her fridge, which we are expected to be thankful for. The problem is that most of these items, such as partially empty jars of salsa, pasta sauce, and cheese, have already gone moldy.
I love these old people.
My mother-in-law is an environmentalist, and I suspect she brings the bad food because then she can claim to create almost no waste. She also brings empty shampoo bottles and leaves them here. I'm tired of hearing her wax poetic about how great she is and then leave me with her biohazardous food to clean up. How can we get her to stop bringing us moldy food?
Oh, so that went a different direction than I thought. That's very cool. That's a great narrative twist. I just assumed these were like people that grew up during the Depression who don't want to waste anything. This is a smug hippie.
Yep.
Yeah, you just have to be like, I'm not eating this. It's moldy.
Well, yeah, this is the genre.
You just have to put your foot
down. This is
down.
A very specific genre.
Also, don't come over so much.
This is a very specific genre of question. This is the in-laws question.
Yeah, yeah.
And the problem with the in-laws is, like, the in-laws are crazy. And, like, the spouse who it's their, like, not their parents feels compelled to put up with their bullshit in some way. But, like, I think most of these problems can just be solved by just flatly just being as clear as possible and just saying, do not bring your garbage to my house. And we'd like
and
it
also,
if you
I'm
came
sorry,
less in general.
your spouse needs to take the lead on their parents.
Well, yes, exactly.
It's like, this is one, you got to be a united front in public. No matter how many laps he takes around the yard on that riding mower, in public, you got to be a united front.
My wife, Borat, she has family friends, and she told me a story about going over to their house. And the woman, and this is a case where, like, they're old people who, like, did grow up, if not depression, you know, hard times. They have, like, that sort of reflexive, sort of hoarder impulse. But she said they gave her a Diet Pepsi, and she tasted it, and she said it really tasted funny. And she looked at the expiration, and it had been expired for, like, 5 years. And I don't know if you guys know this, but things with aspartame in them turn into formaldehyde over time.
Oh, what?
So no,
I didn't know that.
She was drinking formaldehyde.
All right. Here's another good one. Amber, I think you're going to like this one. Question. My partner is a reefer. A person who is obsessed / addicted to saltwater aquariums.
Okay. I'm going to SeaWorld!
He has already had 2 aquariums in the past 4 years. Each time they ended in tragedy. He is a Buddhist, and when something dies in the tank, he goes through a period of mourning.
Okay, don't date white Buddhists.
The worst part is we live in a studio apartment. The equipment used to maintain the aquarium, even a small one, takes up a lot of space and makes noise. I'm not a late sleeper, but a pump whirring all night long gets annoying fast. Once he set up a new system and it sounded like a dishwasher, I just got back into a normal sleeping pattern, and now he's talking about getting another aquarium. I've gone so far as to say, if you get another aquarium, I'm moving out, but he is still pressing the issue. I'm deeply in love and don't want to move out, but what other options do I have?
Look, the best marriage I know of is between my mama and papa, and she leaves him like once every 6 months, just for a couple of days. If he doesn't think you're going to leave, You gotta call that bluff, man. Mm-hmm. You gotta check into a hotel, and you gotta say no fucking aquarium.
You do the thing in A Fish Called Wanda where you take Kevin Klein takes the fish out and eats it in front of
Kevin
Mike.
Klein.
You just terrorize.
Wait a moment! It's fish, isn't it? Oh, here, boy, down the hatch. Oh, delicious! You
better eat the green one? Okay.
I mean, like, obviously the real answer would to be sort of negotiate some other outlet for his terrible hobby that he sucks at. But I would just be like, I'm breaking up with you.
That is that I like that
but
question.
But I would never date what is clearly a white Buddhist, though.
I like that question because it's a category I call the sort of escalating problems where it starts one way and then it just layers on more and more problems. Yeah.
You know, you're just getting a peek.
Like, okay, like, cause it starts out, my partner is obsessed with saltwater aquariums. It's like, well, that's odd, but I could imagine. And then, like, you get to the thing where it's like they're living in a studio apartment together all night long. You just hear the gurgling and rattling of, like, I don't know, the nurse shark that he's keeping in the fucking house.
I can't even live next to an elevated train.
Yeah. Okay. This is a really good one. Next one. I live with 20 people, mostly white, who wanted to have a house discussion on racism. We plan general discussion.
Don't live with 20 people.
Oh, no.
Don't live with 20 people. No. Even the Soviets knew people need personal space.
We planned general discussion questions. How do you identify? What does equality mean to you? What do you think racism is? The group that came to discuss was nearly all white, with a notable exception.
Of course it was.
With a notable exception, a visitor who was a person of color and had seen the flyer about the discussion asked if she could come back to the house for the event.
Episode.
When the group was told about this invitation, they decided to send her away. The reason, it was a discussion intended for the house only. Why were they putting up flyers about this?
You know, because they live with 20 fucking people, and they're like, you know what? Better make sure everyone sees it.
He says,
these are self-absorbed people. You're flyering for a house meeting.
Is it possible I'm overreacting? Can you think of something that makes it okay to be in a group of white people talking about race and sending a person of color away in order to feel safe?
That's not a house discussion. First of all, you're not in a group house. You're not in a punk house. You're in a cult.
No, actually, it didn't say, but the 20 people, this was a hockey team that they were talking about.
People are lonely. Come on. Everyone's an atomized hell being. They want connections. They want to have a rap about racism with their fellow roommates.
All 20 of them.
You know, here's an idea. Why don't you go somewhere where there's more people than just your roommates, and maybe you'll just actually fucking make friends with a non-white person?
Okay, last question.
Leave your house.
Last question, and this one is a doozy. Okay, the title of this question is Dishes Disagreement.
Okay. Innocuous.
Completely innocuous. I wonder how this one will turn out.
I can't wait. This is clearly going to bloom like a rose.
When we got married, my wife, a wonderful person a wonderful person whom I love deeply. That's the other stock Dear Prudy question thing.
Yeah, they have to like prove everything. By the way, I don't hate them.
Yeah.
In the
relationship questions.
Like, I wasn't going to ask.
There's always like the qualifier, you know, my husband, my wife, etc., who I love deeply.
Yeah, the more times they say how
person.
Much they love them in the early part of the letter, that's the number of times that they have Googled ways to get away with murdering someone.
And by the way, this is
how to buy lime.
This is just a little bit of advice I'm going to impart. You can't actually hire a hitman online. They're all undercover cops.
They're all cops, people.
Yeah,
Come on.
Yeah. Unless you are already a member of like a well-known organized crime association, like you're not going to hire a real hitman.
In which case, you know what? Be a man and kill your own wife.
Okay, so let's see where this one goes. So she's a wonderful person whom I love deeply. They agreed on a household division of chores that has worked pretty well until recently. One of my tasks is to wash the dishes, and she'll gather the things in the sink when they're dirty. It turns out, however, she's convinced that anything our one-year-old son touches is consequently filthy. He loves exploring the cabinets, so I frequently walk in to discover basically every pot we own piled in the sink. After an argument about whether this was necessary, I installed child locks on the cabinets, but that's only made things worse, as she now assumes that any cabinet she finds open, for example, because she forgot to close it while cooking, has its contents rifled through by dirty fingers. Rather than wash every pot we own almost every day, I started simply waiting until she was somewhere else and then returning the unused items to the cabinet. When my wife realized what I was doing, however, she started pouring bacon grease on everything so there could be no disagreement about whether it needed to be washed. I think this is incredibly obnoxious, and she just insists that she's making sure that I do my job.
Oh my God.
Both of us are really annoyed. How do we de-escalate?
Sorry, I got to do one more. I got to do one more.
Okay, but first of all, there is no answer to that question. Those people are both crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I love the idea that she's obsessed. Like, this is, the germ of the thing that, like, that isn't discussed is that his wife believes that their one-year-old child is contaminated.
Yeah.
I mean, get
the child things, because they stick their hands down their diapers. They're disgusting little creatures. But, I think it's fine if they have... Why are the cabinets left open if there are the child locks? Something doesn't add up.
Yeah, too many questions about this one.
My advice for them would be to read the pamphlet that's put out by the U.S. government, "So You Gave Birth to a David Cronenberg Baby."
You know what? That's actually the practical solution to problems of human frailty. Just kill your kid.
Yeah.
Problem over.
You heard it here first, folks.
Sorry, one more. I got to do this one. This is the best one. Dear Prudence, I moved in with my girlfriend 7 months ago. We are so happy together. We are so happy together. And after 4 months of blissful cohabiting, I proposed to her. We've planned the perfect wedding and cannot wait for that special day in 9 months. I couldn't be happier. Except for one thing. And okay, whenever I get to this point...
God, I wish I got questions like these. I always get reasonable people like, I'm struggling with depression. And I have to be nice to them. And it's terrible.
This is what I call in the Dear Prudy canon, the Columbo moment. Because I always hear that in Peter Falk's work. One more thing. Okay, except for one thing. Her ex-husband is still living with us in her house.
Record scratch!
They've been divorced for a year.
You're probably wondering how I got into this.
They've been divorced for a year, and he's been living rent-free in her home ever since. She is also paying his car note every month. She says that she feels sorry for him and that he is only working part-time. I admire her so much for her gracious spirit, but I just don't want to live with her ex-husband forever. It's her house, so I don't really feel like I have a say in the matter. Am I out of line for not wanting to share a home with this man, or is there a good way for me to bring this up with my future bride?
He spends all of his money on podcasts. A particular one.
He says he would move out, but for neoliberals.
Oh, that's amazing. He's like, I don't know. Am I being pushy for not wanting to live with my fiance's boyfriend? I don't know. I feel weird.
The word cuck gets thrown around.
Actually, yeah, no, I mean, that's not her ex-husband. That's her boyfriend. He didn't get divorced. She just demoted him.
Yes. No, but this one, just like so many of these questions, just cry out for just direct confrontation.
Yeah.
And just not sparing anyone's feelings.
Why
just
I get these questions?
It's funny to imagine them planning their wedding together and the ex-husband's like, "Oh, maybe you should yeah.
Yeah. He's like, "I don't know if those flowers would be good for spring."
Definitely chicken and salmon.
Also, he's gonna be the maid of honor and my best man. You already volunteered him. Am I being an asshole about this?
So,
I wish I got Dear Prudy style question.
Just start taking these. No one will know.
Again, that email is yoursorryass@thebaffler.com. Mm-hmm. Please, please bug Amber if you have problems in your life anywhere near as funny as Dear Prudy's reader.
Just juice it up a little. You know, whatever your problem is. Just lie a little bit.
Yeah, you know what? Like, here's the thing. I don't make up my questions, but if you embellish, I have no way of knowing.
There we go. So, again, advice Amber.
And I promise when I actually write my responses for the job that I have that I take very seriously, I'm not as stoned and drunk as I am right now.
And you will give, you know, good, solid advice.
Yeah, I take
you won't tell anyone to kill their child.
I will not.
Okay. All right, guys. Till next time.
Yeah.
Cheers, everybody. Clea,
cheers.
Thanks
Thank
for
you
hanging
for
out.
Having me.
Yeah.
All right, bye.
Bye.
You can follow up and tell me what that means, and I'll try my best to do it for you.